So what we have been working with for the last so many weeks is, first we worked with right spiritual attitude, and for those of you who are just joining in, if you go to the same place on the internet that I was talking about, you'll find the other classes if you want to catch up on what we have already done. First we did the right attitudes for the spiritual path. What is attitude and what are the right attitudes? We went through that. Courage, positive thinking at all times, even-minded and cheerful, living for God alone. Is that it? Courage, positive thinking at all times, even-minded and cheerful, living for God alone. And there is one more. Serving the God in all. Is that it? So I have to always try to remember those. We should all be remembering them, but here we are. Oh, I know, it's right here on the first page. Here it is. Courage, positive thinking, even-minded and cheerful, serving the divine in all. I did get it. Yes. Okay. And now we're working with the necessities on the spiritual path, which are devotion, willpower, discrimination. Then comes attunement with guru, practicing the presence of God, following the vows, regular practice of the techniques, willingness, enthusiasm, even-mindedness, and overcoming the lower qualities to embrace the higher. We have spent all our time so far on devotion, and now we're up to willpower. And will, he calls it, not just willpower. And after that is discrimination. We'll see how far we get tonight. Remember that the first time I read this, there was a typo, and it was said determination instead of discrimination, which I turned into a necessity on the spiritual path, but because determination is another aspect of willpower, and that was how we were able to do it. So with that brief introduction, are we all ready? Any questions? Does anybody have anything they remember from the last time that they need to ask about? Or anything like that? We are planning to only do two of these classes because then Swamiji is going to start doing a Tuesday night class in Los Angeles that'll be streamed, a live stream. So at exactly the same time, there'll be a different class that he'll be giving live in Los Angeles. We'll be watching by video. The price structure of that is completely different. You've probably all received word on that, so If for any reason a cost of that class precludes your attending it, speak to us. We're not sponsoring it, so we only have some control, but we have some control. So speak to us if you can't afford to come to the class, which is all about prosperity. But these things happen, and we don't want anybody to not be able to come. It's not our policy to exclude people if they can't afford it. Swami, at the present moment, however, he's been in Hawaii for a month. He was supposed to fly home day after tomorrow. When he first arrived in Hawaii, he had what appeared to be a superficial, whatever they call it, a blood clot on his right leg, on his calf, which was healing up perfectly well. But just yesterday or the day before, it suddenly got infected. So at the present time, he won't be able to fly until that infection clears up. The infection seems to be clearing up. He's under a doctor's care. So presumably by 2 weeks from tonight, is it 3 weeks from tonight? It'll be 3 weeks from tonight. Oh, 2 weeks, right, because I do one class. Presumably by 2 weeks from tonight, he'll be back in Los Angeles. But if for any reason he's not, just show up anyway, and it'll be me, and we'll just go on with this one. Okay. So what we're going to talk about now is will. It's interesting, he doesn't call it willpower. He just talks about it as will and its importance on the spiritual path. He still emphasizes that devotion is the first necessity on the spiritual path. But he also really starts talking now about how even devotion requires the use of the will. In the story of the Mahabharata, which of course is a marvelous epic, just as a storytelling, as a moment, just as a tale, a fabulous tale, you have five heroic brothers, and they're at war with their cousins, as it happens, and it's symbolic of the internal war that takes place within the devotee. The battle of Kurukshetra, the field of Kurukshetra, is the field of our own consciousness. It's an interesting, I'll digress just a little to get this picture. Well, it's not a digression, it's exact about this. We talk about there being three levels of consciousness when we're talking about spiritual development. We talk about the subconscious, which is the repository, it's the storehouse of everything that happens to us is stored in the subconscious. And when you think of it from a metaphysical point of view, it gets a little more interesting and a little more exact. Because we are ego-identified with the actions that we take and the experiences of our lives, you know, we make this mistake, as Master calls it, of thinking that everything that happens to us personally concerns us personally. That's the way he puts it. And we, of course, think, well, of course it does, because we are identified, the ego is identified with the body in which the spirit finds itself, and all the self-definitions that expand out from that, male, female, age, nationality, health, wealth, everything. We identify with this. We don't actually lose our infinity, but we lose track of our infinity because we have become identified with this experience. I mean, we know how that is. Just even for a moment, if you identify with something, if you're some friends of ours were, when Swamiji gave a program in Los Angeles and he gave an open house on the roof of this hotel. It was just a small hotel. And everybody wanted to get up to the roof quickly, so about 16 people crowded into this small elevator, and the elevator broke between the floors. And it was some of our more expansive individuals. It was an elevator full of really big people. So it wasn't just 16 like small people, it was 16 really big people. And it was very claustrophobic in there. And some people began to identify deeply with that experience. I wasn't in that elevator, but became quite anxious, you know, being confined in that elevator, crammed in like that, and then suddenly not able to get out. Somebody had an iPod and or a telephone, and they had Swami chanting Om, and they pushed it. Were any of you in the elevator? I don't know. Nobody's nodding their head. Pushed it, and so sort of like one of the people who was feeling a little panicky in there thought that Swami was chanting for them. You know, thought that on the roof Swami was chanting, and he was coming in. But it took her out of the moment, you know, instead of just being conscious of my body's caught in this elevator. I mean, there was never any danger that anything would happen, except what did happen was that the elevator people came and let them out. But, you know, the reason that one is panicked is because one has become deeply identified with that experience. It's a very transitory experience, but if you're identified with it, you can go all kinds of places. Bringing the Om vibration in, at least for some of them, move them out of that short-term identification into a longer reality, and they were able to stay relatively calm until they were released from there. They took the stairs for the rest of the time Swami was visiting. But, I mean, a lot of us took the stairs. But we're identified with the things that happen to us, and they register in our chakras. Our chakras are the place where our experiences accumulate. And the magnetic pattern of the chakras is what literally creates our reality. Because it creates the sum total of who and what we think we are. You know, I've had a few past memories of past lives that were somewhat traumatic. You know, one came in a dream, another just came in as a clear, just sort of intuition, you might say. Very traumatic experiences. The past lives of all of us are. And not innocent traumas, you know, traumas that I fully participated in attracting to myself, but nonetheless I experienced them, you know, bad things that happen that remain unresolved. I mean, just think about the things you see. A jealous husband shoots his wife. Your son dies in an accident. Somebody told me of a memory they had of me. It was very interesting. I was telling a story about how there was a period of time in my life when David and I were traveling a lot, where every time I was separated from him in the airport, I would gradually become really quite agitated, you know. And he was very, you know, we'd go to the gate. I'd always want to go to the gate and sit at the gate. And he would always want to wander around. And he would just go wander around. He'd come back in plenty of time. He's not a moron. He's not going to miss the plane. But I would find myself just becoming quite unhinged. So by the time he would get back, I'd be way outside myself. Finally, you know, it took him quite some time to realize I was serious because it was just so absurd. Finally, we'd make a deal. You know, okay, you're going to leave now. You will be back exactly at this time. You will not be late. And he began to realize that, ridiculous as it seemed, he had to do it. Gradually, we traveled so much that I got over it. And then I finally would think about things like, so he misses the plane. Like, you know, that's like his problem, not my problem. I also realized that I could just have a fit, you know, with the airline people, and they wouldn't take off until we found him. That was actually more how I saved him. But I told that story in a satsang once, and this woman comes up to me, and true or otherwise, I don't know. She certainly felt it was true. She told me the story of seeing me as a little girl, and my mother died, and my father couldn't take care of me, and he took me to another town and just abandoned me in a train station. And, you know, she said this picture of this little girl with this little sack. I mean, actually, it makes me very, I get short of breath when I hear it, you know. So I think it was true. Because that was the feeling that I had, was just that if I got separated from David, it would just be the end of the world. And there was no reason for that. But, you know, her saying that to me, well, it was quite sensible. And then oddly, because I didn't want the fear to linger, I could feel how that experience had been both a blessing and a curse to me. That in that lifetime, I developed a tremendous amount of willpower because I was so helpless. But I also developed a certain degree of insensitivity because I just had to struggle so hard to survive. You can see how those things would play against each other. But I'm using that as a very specific example because I can still feel the energy in me. And in our subconscious, all of these experiences register. You know, so I'm a little girl there. Let's just say if it's not true, it could be apocryphal. It fits. These things happen. I'm a little girl there. I'm suddenly abandoned. I have to figure out my whole life, you know, and these things don't necessarily resolve. They just become the things that happen. And that feeling of abandonment or lack of being loved, not being taken care of, an unreasonable sense of having to take care of yourself, all these different things, it stays there. And you're born the next time with an inclination in that direction. Or I was starting to say, maybe your jealous husband shoots you. And you're innocent, or maybe you're guilty and you feel terrible. Maybe you run off with somebody else and you abandon your children, and then at the end of your life, you know, you have this great sense of anguish of what you didn't do. What happens to all of that energy? I mean, no such luck that it just vaporizes, because we were identified with those experiences. They register in the chakras at the appropriate vibration between ego, commitment, and spiritual freedom. And of course, you have blissful lives in an ashram, you're very devoted, you spend a whole lifetime washing the feet of the lepers, you are with Christ in Jerusalem. Those things also register. When we went to Badrinath in India for the first time, which is very high in the mountains, about 12,000 feet in the mountains, and to get up there you stop at Josimath, which is about 7,000 feet. We stopped. We spent the night in Josimath. It was just a stopover on the way. But there's an ashram there that was founded by Adi Shankaracharya, the first Shankaracharya of India, who created reorganized the Swami order and actually founded the Badrinath ashram. And the Badrinath temple is essentially devoted to Babaji. So there's a whole link there. I mean, totally, I had no relationship to any of this. Oh, we're in Josimath. We were leading this pilgrimage. Oh, we're in Josimath. Okay, we have a day to kill. I think we got stuck there, actually, because of a road slide. So we'll go over to this ashram. I stepped onto that ashram grounds. I felt so happy. I felt so at home. It just felt so completely familiar to me. It never crossed my mind before. Then later, Swami starts talking about the relationship between our path and Adi Shankaracharya. He even asserted that Master was Adi Shankaracharya. And every time he would say that, I said, well, all I can say, sir, is when I went to that ashram, it was just like, I loved being there. Never thought about it before. So all these things are in us. Now, that reality is what, when we speak spiritually speaking, we speak of that as our subconscious. Our subconscious is just the big storehouse of everything that ever happened. Just literally like the memory on a computer. It's not creative. It may reassemble the pieces, but it doesn't make anything new. It just has everything that's ever been. So it's sort of like everything you used to be. It's not where you're going, but it's everything that made you who you are up until this point. And it roils around in the chakras. And depending how strong those feelings are, it creates these vrittis, which are whirlpools, and they draw you in. You know, I'm in the airport, you know, it's my husband, not my father. I have my own passport. He's going to be on the plane. But in here is this thought that if I'm traveling and I lose sight of especially the man who's taking care of me, then absolute panic ensues. Just out of all reason, panic ensues because there's a vritti. There's a whirlpool within me, the center of which is terrible fear, just terrible fear. So anything that even floats close to that, just sucked right into it, right? In no amount of reason, I mean, gradually, in fact, reason did overcome that. But at first, it just totally owned me. And it's utterly subconscious because there's nothing in the present reality to support that. But there's enough in the present reality that reminds me of it, and the past is stronger than the present. So that's the subconscious level of reality. And where we normally live is more or less our conscious mind. I mean, when we go into sleep, we enter into a subconscious state. We lose the conscious will at that point. Well, I'll go back to sleep in just a moment. But in a normal state, we're awake. And so we can bring to bear a degree of reason and a degree of willpower on the situation. Because we're not only the product of everything that we have been. We are also the expression of what we truly are. And what we truly are is superconscious. And it is the superconscious self, which is the superconscious, the point at which the individual meets the infinite, so to speak. I mean, it's just a way to think about it. It's like through the superconscious is when we connect to the infinite. And we have descended from infinity. Our true nature is infinite, but we have incarnated into a physical body. We've created a physical body that reflects the state of our chakras, you know, that right to this point, that's why you're male, female, in whatever culture you are, whatever country you grew up in, whatever parents you chose, whatever your physical body looks like, all of these things are an exact reflection of essentially what you needed to be next, given all the karmic experiences that you have. I have had a friend, little tiny woman, shorter than me, and just sort of exceedingly skinny at the time, just a really skinny little girl, with sort of big hands and big feet, just kind of a skinny person. And she had this huge Land Rover. It was the most incongruous vehicle. You know, she practically, you know, had to pry herself, you know, virtually needed to boost up to just get into the car. And at one point I said to her, "This is the most unlikely vehicle for you." She says, "It feels right to me." And she sort of said that she could kind of remember herself as just being a great hulking man who just completely dependent on his physical strength. And she sort of felt she was born as such a skinny little girl because it was just, she was so extreme in that strength that she was just imbalanced and was trying to balance it back. But she couldn't lose the sort of mental concept of herself as this big, strong, masculine thing. So, you know, she would, in the few ways that she could manifest it, like this big automobile, she would drive this big automobile around because it felt like the right size for her consciousness. I was joking once with a friend of mine. I was talking to him about another friend who has a very large physical body. And I was just commenting about, you know, I have a small body, basically. It used to be even smaller. And I was just struck by how big this man's hands and, you know, his feet and his limbs, just everything. He's just an oversized human being. And I realized the man I was talking to was also an oversized human being like this. And he just looked at me and he says, "It feels like the right size for my consciousness." Is how he put it. And I realized, well, of course it does. It doesn't seem big to him. It's just the body that his chakras needed to make. You know, and so that's the body that he lives through. We manifest the body that gives us the best chance at expressing the maximum consciousness. This is the most interesting way to understand how animals evolve. You know, if you're a lizard, you have certain potentialities as a lizard. And they may be greater potentialities than, for example, an ant would have. An ant always is trapped with all his brothers and sisters and doesn't really have much chance for individual expression. a lizard can at least run around, be on a rock all by himself, get a little privacy every now and then, you know, have a little personal initiative. He can eat ants. You know, he can just do all sorts of things like this. It's not compared to a puppy. It doesn't have nearly as much opportunity as a puppy or a horse, but it's got more than an ant. So through many, many incarnations, we manifest the body that is the limit of the present consciousness that we can express. And when we're finished with that, then we get to manifest another kind of body, and gradually we progress. That's the story of Master in Autobiography of a Yogi with the little deer that he was so attached to, and he didn't want his little fawn to die. But the spirit of the fawn came to him in a dream and said, "I'm finished. I'm done being a fawn. I'm ready to be something else. You know, don't hold me as a fawn. It's not the end of the story." In essence, and Master realized that he was making an error out of his attachment. The fawn was finished being a fawn. It was ready to progress on from that, probably because of its association with Yogananda. If nothing else, it had awoken its consciousness. Now, all of that is saying we are manifesting the level of consciousness we've reached at this point, but that does not define our potential or even our reality. And this is where that wonderful word identification with comes. We are identified with all these past experiences. The fact that I could panic in the airport is because I still identify with being abandoned. You know, a part of me still lives in that reality of being abandoned. You know, I'm not abandoned. I was extremely well taken care of in this lifetime. I've been very well taken care of. I can travel on my own. But I still, I would say to a very large extent, I've passed out of it. But when that woman brought it up to me, and when I think of it, I can still get a little agitated inside. But I don't panic in the airport anymore, because I now know that I'm not that little girl. I've shifted my consciousness. The fear I still identify with. Do you understand? It's like that potential for fear still has a vritti inside of me. So that's all the subconscious that influence us, but merely because we have imagined ourselves to be limited and have imagined that all these experiences have to define us doesn't actually mean that they have to define us or that they do define us. The only way I can think to say it is, if you're caught, like somebody plays an elaborate practical joke on you, and they set up some whole thing, and you or a surprise party. We did a surprise party for David once at the house that we live in now. We didn't live in it, but we scheduled it for someone else, and we were supposed to go over there for some reason, I think for a meeting, and the whole community was in on it, and they were all in that house, and David, who's such a hard worker, he was, you know, we were about to go over there, and he was trying to call people for some reason to do this business and that business. He couldn't figure out why no one was home. It was just really annoying him, because no one was home, because they were all hiding in the house waiting for us to come over, so no one was answering their phones. I don't think we had cell phones then. And we opened the door to the house, and he thought he was coming to a meeting, and he walked in, and about, I don't know, 50 or 60 people just jumped from the woodwork and screamed, "Surprise, happy birthday." He sort of fell to the floor. Afterwards, he said, "Please don't ever do that to me again." You know, it was like he had a certain expectation of reality at that point. He was committed to it. He was going over there for a meeting. He couldn't figure out where everybody was, but he was going over there for a meeting. But that it wasn't true. Just something else was happening. No matter how deeply we believe that I am this person, that these things have happened to me, that this is a real experience, that that's a real experience, if it's just like shadow and light that we have misinterpreted, if you're walking through a jungle and there's a vine hanging down and you think it's a snake, you all put that snake, that like supposedly squirrel-scaring snake that had absolutely no effect on the squirrels, they put it in the persimmon tree outside our house, and it's a very real-looking snake. And I walked up to it, and like this, you know? And in my mind, it was like, this is America. This isn't India. It's not likely that there's poisonous snakes. But I thought it must be somebody's pet that's gotten away. And I'm about to call you, because you're the person I always call for things like that, because David is a deer but not real useful in such moments, so I call you. And I'm thinking about, you know, do I go up close? Do I back up and call him? Does anyone else know? And finally I got close enough to see its head, and when I saw it, because it was just like, even though it was really convincing to me, there was a part of me that thinks, this is extremely strange. So then I saw its head, and I saw it was stuffed, but it had me, totally had me. But it didn't make it true. It just wasn't true. But it had registered as if it was true. And even to a certain extent, you know, that agitation registers in your body. And your subconscious will remember and won't know that your conscious mind has solved the problem. It just registers in your body and stays there. Because it's interesting, I'll mention one more story. One of our trips to India, when we used to take these pilgrimage tours, we used to go, we'd land in New Delhi, and we'd go the first day we were there, the next morning, we'd go to this big temple that was a little bit outside of town. It's now like acres of big temples, and that time it was less built. There was a stone temple, and we would often hit during the big festival time when they would have the 10 days of Durga festival. It's a big thing. And thousands of people would come to this place, and they didn't have big enough buildings at that time, so they'd build onto this small temple in this huge open courtyard, what they called a pandala, which is like a tent, cloth and wood strips and so on like that. And then they'd wire it for electricity and decorate it with flowers and so on. No building codes, you know, nothing like that. And, you know, the pandals catching fire is a regular part of festival season because the electric shorts out. It's all done in a very casual way. So we were in that temple, actually not in the main room, but in a small room. You were there. And the pandala caught fire. Fortunately, it was very orderly, and they got everybody out. But we were in this back room, and so the fire was, you know, well underway before we even knew it was happening. And then somebody came rushing through and basically said, the temple's on fire, you better get out of here. So about 30 of us, or maybe a few more, we got up and we ran out of the temple, and people ran in two directions. Well, David and Vidura, and I think you too, but I think you got out. Did you go back with them? No, you didn't go back with them. The two of them thought, maybe we can help. So they went back toward the temple. Everybody else went out this way. We went out two ways. Some people went across the street and ran parallel to the temple. And some of us went across the street and just kept going. You know, there was ways to keep getting. So we got far enough away. People who ran parallel to the temple actually got burned by the hot air. The group that I was part of, we went far enough away that we didn't get burned. But David and Vidura turned in. They saw that the temple was both empty and, you know, it was like as big as this. And it was in flames, so they turned back. They ran out across this small courtyard, and they came to an 8-foot brick wall. To this day, David doesn't really know how he got over that wall. He really doesn't. He just suddenly was on the other side of the wall. And he had his left hand and his face like this, and he actually got a burn like this. He had to grow a beard because of the flame. Vidura, just to finish the story, who was right behind David, heard somebody, turned like that, and saw a woman and her child behind him. He turned, saw them, turned back, and in that moment, flame came between them. It was a big adventure. So David's on the other side of the wall, thinking that Vidura's right behind him, and all of a sudden, he's just looking at flame. He's not looking at Vidura. I mean, there was nothing that could be done. Vidura has great presence of mind, sees this woman and child, and he realizes that he has just run out of a small concrete building. And that there's nothing flammable anywhere around. So he knows that there's nothing he can do now, so he just takes the woman and the girl, and he just goes back into the concrete building and closes the door, and has there was sort of a wooden door there and a little spigot. The woman didn't speak any English. She just spoke whatever village dialect she had. But he didn't want the door to burn. Vidura, again, has a great presence of mind. So every so often he would open the door, and he would throw a lot of water on the door, and then he would close it again. Of course, every time he opened the door, the woman began to scream because she didn't know what was going on and he didn't have any way of explaining it to her. But he's calculating the whole thing, and he's actually seeing that, you know, they'll be fine because there's just a few flammable things and it'll just burn right over them. They, you know, they stay close to the ground and so on. But there we all are, and we're scattered all over this. You know, this is all happening like that. And so I've led a group out. And so I'm where God knows where, separated from everyone, and we're all regrouping, and Vidura and David aren't with us. And so they I realized that David wasn't with us. I mean, Durga and I are together, and we both realized that our husbands are not with us. And then someone told me, I didn't know any of this, someone said, oh yeah, they ran back in like this. Yeah. And you know, by now we're looking at four stories of flames. I mean, it was quite dramatic. Well, there we are. And it's just like, there was just this moment when he would be here if he were here. I guess he's gone. And it just registered right through me. This was the whole point of this. It just registered right through me. And it was only, I think it was less than a minute, when Derek Van Atta walks up to me and he says, oh no, David gave me his things, and he hands me his stuff, and I think like, oh, you know, this is the last remnant, is this little meditation gear. And then he says, oh no, he's two blocks down the road, I just saw him. You know, then it was about 45 minutes before we knew what had happened to Vidura. Durga felt certain that he was fine. She said he stayed and helped someone. She just knew him too well. And then what happened was, after the fire burned out, we had left our shoes at the gate, so we're all barefoot, and there's all this hot ash all around, so they couldn't come out. I mean, they were fine. They were perfectly fine, but they couldn't come out because they were barefoot, and they couldn't walk across the hot coals. They had to wait till people came and cleared it out. But what was so interesting to me, to go where I was going with all of this, is for about 1 minute, I had to face the reality that he'd been burned up and might be dead. Then it was over. But the next day, it was like my subconscious mind didn't know that he was fine. That's the only way I can say it. It just didn't know that he was fine. And my physical body didn't know that he was fine. It was like I could feel the trauma, like, all through me. And I realized, my God, this is how people get sick. Is that things happen to them, a trauma registers, and it just aberrates things. And imagine if it really, you know, if you live with it for a long time and allow it to really affect you, then the energy is skewed in certain ways, and then you have to live through whatever that's going to produce in you, and something's going to happen. And I was thinking, gosh, nothing even happened to me, but I can feel this. And it was extremely tempting to say, oh, everything's fine now. Everything's just fine. He wasn't burned up in the fire. Everything's fine. But I realized, you know, he was fine today, and tomorrow he'll be burned up. It's like there's no promise merely because he escaped this time. There's no promise. I can't make myself secure by telling myself a lie, which is everything's always going to be fine forever. My father will never abandon me in the station again, you know, because I'll never have a father who won't be able to take care of me. I mean, how am I going to be able to make any promise like that? And what we do is we have one delusion, and we solve it with another delusion, and then we add a delusion on top of that, and then not only are we betrayed, but we feel betrayed because we were betrayed, because we promised it would never happen again, and, you know, just gets so mixed up. So I said to myself, you know, the only way to really release this trauma is to face the terror of it, the tragedy of it, and be transcend the actual tragedy. Do you see what I mean? And so we the next day we were at the Gandhi Memorial. We were still in Delhi. I know this because there's a photograph of me sitting under this tree. It's a very interesting photograph. Actually, I must say, it's a beautiful photograph because I went into such a deep meditation, because that was when I was like, you know, trying to function, and I was still like this for no reason. And so I just sat down to meditate, and I just went through this long visualization, and I just replayed the whole thing, except I had him die. Because that I had to find peace with him dying, not with him not dying. And I had to get my body and my subconscious mind to be at peace with that, because that was the only way that I could really be free of it. I went really, really, really deep into that experience. That's why the photograph is so interesting to me, because I just look at it, and there was just a very unusual aura around my face, because I knew exactly what I was doing from when it was taken. And I walked the whole thing through again, except I made it tragic, so to speak, that he died. His parents were still living at the time, his sister, you know, I had to phone them all, I had to talk to them about how he died, we had to discuss whether he'd be cremated, whether we'd bring his body back to America, I mean, everything. I did the whole thing all the way through. I came home to the empty house, I went upstairs to the room where he would never come back again. I opened his closet. I started giving away his shirts. You know, the blue one would be nice on so-and-so. Who should get the flowered one? This would be good. I got up to Lee Starkey trying to think which shirts Lee would like. And then I thought, I think that's enough. So I never really picked out any shirts for Lee. But it was just like, and then I just felt this, like, okay, we're fine now. And after that, I was just very, the whole trauma was out of me. Now, that was a very interesting conscious experience of purging the subconscious. But most of time, the subconscious, and this is where I went in a long digression there, but it's an extremely illustrative digression, that the real reality is our superconsciousness. And the way that I dealt with that was not just merely gritting my teeth that it's okay, but I really took it in a superconscious direction. Okay, we come to India on pilgrimage and David dies. You know, he dies. These things happen. He's gone on to the astral world. He was over. He was finished with this incarnation. We didn't expect it to happen in New Delhi in a temple fire, but let's say it did. So my life goes on because I have identified with this life, but this isn't who I am. I'm that infinite reality, and I solved the problem. God knows whether I could have if he'd really died. I don't know. You know, I wasn't challenged like that. By going into the superconscious reality, because that's always who we really are. And these two realities are always pulling on us. One is, everything is just fine. You're one with the infinite. What do you ever worry about anything? Live, die, poor, rich, sick, well. I mean, on one level, who cares? It's just waves on the ocean. And we're only thinking it's so important when we're caught in the up or the down. But when we're scuba diving way underneath it, we don't even care what's going on in the surface. We did the scuba diving for a little while, and it's so peculiar. You go down, and it's a completely other universe. It's an extraordinary, huge other universe. It's quite different even than snorkeling, because you go down into it. Then you come up, and the whole surface world has been going on the whole time. But you just had no relationship to it, because it was just happening on the surface, and you were in the depths. It's a magnificent spiritual analogy. So all those waves are always going up and down, and we call that our life. But the truth is, they're just waves on the ocean, and the ocean is really what we are. The ocean is the superconsciousness always pulling us, be even-minded, cheerful, positive attitude at all times. You know, there's just, think about God alone. And I was starting to speak way a long time ago about the Mahabharata, the field of Kurukshetra, is actually, you see, the subconscious world is trying to hold us to all of our ego-based experiences. The superconscious is trying to liberate us from even the whole identification with ego, and the two of them fight it out in your conscious mind. And that's where I was when, you know, David, I thought David was dead. It was, he'd become this subconscious grip on me. My conscious mind couldn't deal with it because the subconscious was pulling me too hard and it had registered physically. So I had to push into superconscious and let the superconscious wash it through. You know, I mean, I didn't attain a high state of superconsciousness, but I went in that direction. And the battle of Kurukshetra is between these two forces all the time. And the field is our own consciousness. Now, all of this relates to will, willpower. Because if we imagine that because spiritual life is natural to us, and because our true nature is bliss, that we can get there just by leaning backwards and just, you know, sort of floating on the top of the waves, it's not going to happen. Because it's a battle that's going on, because there's so much commitment, so much past life commitment to an entirely other reality, that if we don't put out energy, it just sucks us in. If you're going down a river where there's a lot of whirlpools and you come to one of those whirlpools, I was talking, was it a Sunday sometime recently? Oh, it was the New Year's Eve about the whitewater rafting trip we took on the River Ganges when we thought we were having a pleasant stroll down this mild river and instead we were in, I don't know, class 4, class 5 white water. It was really quite something. You know, there was another tiny aspect to that, which, since many of you heard it, that trip, which was hours long and freezing cold and extremely agitated and very dangerous. And in truth, actually, none of us ever fell out of the boats the whole time, even though, amazing, we never fell out of the boats. After that trip, Durga and Vidura and David and I, because we were on the other side of the world with these trips, we'd often go someplace for a vacation afterwards, because leading a group of Americans in India for a month was really tiring. So we went to Bali, and we saw this river rafting trip. And since we were old hands at river rafting, we signed up for this trip, and we're in this, like, you know, a river that's going about 3 miles an hour, perfectly warm, beautiful bathtub water, lovely jungles like this. Absolutely nothing happened. I fell out of the boat. And it was the oddest thing. I was just sitting in the boat, absolutely nothing was happening, and all of a sudden I'm looking up at my feet. And I have no idea, and nobody else in the boat has any idea how it happened. All I thought was it was my karma to fall out of the boat, but it was too dangerous to fall out in the Ganges, so it just waited till I was in this whatever it was, and then whammo, my feet are over my head, and I'm tumbling into the water. Everybody's laughing hysterically as they pull me in because it was so ridiculous. But the point being, you head down the river, there are these whirlpools, you have to work really hard to get past them. Otherwise, they'll just eat you up. And vritti is whirlpool, and that's what we have in our subconscious mind. If we just drift, we just don't progress. We just repeat. We just repeat and repeat and repeat. You know, people say, I have abandonment issues. You know, I have security issues. And it's true, we do. We have those vrittis, we have those whirlpools, and they're always just hovering, waiting to eat our consciousness. And if we don't want to have them, we have to use a tremendous amount of willpower to hold our consciousness and move it in the direction we're trying to go. It just does not happen automatically. And in the Bhagavad Gita, when you have the five heroes, they each represent one of the chakras. And Arjuna is the third brother, and he represents the third chakra, which is the navel chakra, and this is the chakra of willpower and self-control, fiery self-control. This is the fire center. And even though all the brothers are very powerful, the way the story is told, everything depends on Arjuna. If Arjuna doesn't fight, then they absolutely will lose. And this is the Bhagavad Gita, is the discussion between Krishna and Arjuna about whether or not Arjuna is going to fight. And it's pretty darn important. Krishna has to persuade Arjuna that he really has to fight. Because if he doesn't fight, his side is going to lose. His brothers will not be able to stand unless he's engaged. And because he represents our willpower. And even though Bhima has wonderful heart and Yudhishthira has wonderful wisdom, if the willpower is not engaged, if we don't exercise, if we don't use our will to exercise fiery self-control, the past habits will just take us and the new reality will never assert itself. It's also that the self-control is midway between the five chakras which govern our human life, and whichever way the willpower goes, either drags the upper two chakras down or it lifts the lower two chakras up. And Arjuna doesn't want to fight. He has all these really good reasons why he's not going to do it. It's like, it's too much trouble, it's too tiresome, what have we really got to win, why is it worth it, why would I want to kill all these people, it seems like such a drag, isn't peace a better value, like how did I ever get myself into this in the first place? I mean, just on and on and on and on. It's everything that we say, isn't it? But this is my own nature. How can I deny myself? I really have to relate to these things. Isn't there some way we can all live together? And can't I just drink a little bit? And you know, it's just like we have all these rationalizations. Krishna's first response to Arjuna when he presents them is, you have clever words, but you're behaving like a coward and a fool. I mean, just dismisses him just like that. And then the rest of the Gita is Arjuna saying, oh my gosh, really? Is that what's happening? And then he raises all these other questions. But it's all about willpower. And so first is devotion. But even devotion requires willpower. Because to really be devoted to the cause that we have embraced, we have to dedicate every ounce of our strength to be able to do it. So let's take a break.
So this subconscious is like a big bucket. It keeps filling up, or is it starts emptying as your life keeps going?
No, because it's all your incarnate. Well, it either empties or it fills. Okay, your subconscious is the repository of your karma. And your subconscious is the pattern in your chakras. And it constantly shifts, because every time you have a response, a reaction, a thought, an attitude, okay, every single response that you have is a vibration of consciousness, and it's somewhere on the spectrum between I am a material being, that's my only reality, I am this body, the only thing that matters what happens to my body, to I am one with the infinite spirit, and Om is my body, and Christ consciousness. And every time something happens, you have a really deep meditation, you meditate at the spiritual eye, you create a lot of magnetism at the spiritual eye in the superconscious direction. You are over here and somebody tempts you to be able to get some money by a not quite honest method, and it might really hurt some people, but gee, I could really use it. And so you take and you hurt people and you think about yourself, and it registers as that vibration, that you wouldn't do that if you had a higher level of awareness, or you have fear about something or anger. All of that is a certain vibration of consciousness, and whatever vibration it is, it's like putting a penny in the bank of whatever chakra represents that vibration. So at any moment, moment by moment, the energy pattern in your chakras is being recreated by your actions. And especially Kriya, which is the river running through the chakras. And if the river running through the chakras is stronger than the magnetism of any of those vrittis, whirlpools, the vritti will dissolve into the river. That's how Kriya works out your karma. Like when the river gets in flood, there aren't as many whirlpools because the river is so strong that the whirlpools can't stand against it. So every time we run that Kriya current up and down the spine, all the vrittis of karma that have less energy to be whirlpools than the river has to flow, they just get sucked into the river. And the vrittis dissolve, the karma dissolves, without ever having to be acted out. So every time you practice Kriya, every time you do one Kriya, on some level, there's some shift happening. And anything that raises the kundalini, there's some shift. So from the beginning of the day to the end of the day, from the beginning of an incarnation to the end of the incarnation, everything is going in a new direction. And that's why Yogananda says, take care of the minutes. Because your consciousness is being recreated on a minute-by-minute basis. That's why those attitudes, even-minded and cheerful, positive thinking at all times, courage, because each time, I was saying this one of the days in the last few days, we are nothing but a vibration of consciousness. We are the Word. That's what it was, I was saying it on Sunday. We are the Word. And if we keep our vibration where it's supposed to be, it really doesn't matter whether or not we succeed or fail in any way that anybody can see, because we might or we might not. But if our vibration is continually responding on the level of our aspirations, then we're storing up energy in the chakras and we're creating a new magnetic pattern. So you're never the same. You're not the same. That's why judging yourself is just so ridiculous. Because what are you judging? You're judging the river as it used to be. And by the time you're looking at it, it's gone. You know, that one water molecule that you're looking at right now is past. So you sort of seize your energy in this little snapshot and define that as yourself. But the moment that you take the picture, it's over. So the only thing that's really true is where you're going, which is to the sea, in fact. Did that answer the question that you asked? It's very important to understand that this is all about willpower, even though I've hardly touched it. But it's really all about willpower. This is why willpower is so important, because you're never lost. You're just a pattern. And if you just start trying to recreate a new pattern by deliberately applying your energy, that's why all the attitudes that we spent so much time on at the beginning are so important. Because you see, if you have the right attitude toward what's happening, you're registering in the right chakras, so to speak. You're registering the right vibrations. And then those vibrations create the magnetism and the karma, which brings you the next event. And so that everything in future will improve if you make the right spiritual effort now. It's a metaphysical law. It's not just a sentimental thought. It's a fact. Because if you're making the right spiritual effort now, you are rearranging the vrittis in your chakras. And in the next minute, your magnetism will be different than it was a minute ago, and it'll be more toward tipping the balance where you'll hear superconsciousness before you'll hear subconsciousness. You know, there comes a point in our lives where, you know, what used to hold us, people will tell you that. I mean, you've told me experiences, other people have told me experiences. I used to really always habitually do this or that, and now I just don't. And you don't even know why you stopped sometimes. Sometimes you fought the battle and won, but sometimes you don't even know why you stopped. It's just that you kept putting out energy at a higher vibration, and gradually that lower vibration simply got drawn into the higher vibration. And so you just don't go there anymore because it's not you anymore. I mean, it literally is not you. It's not you to go to that particular habit or that particular entertainment or that particular relationship or that particular reaction. It's astonishing. You just think, wow, look at this. I mean, I recently just, you know, some things I was struggling with, I've been struggling with them for about 30 years. You know, just old pictures in my mind. And I just suddenly realized the other day, they're just not there. I just can't conjure up those same reactions. You know, it wasn't like a big central part of my life, but it was just annoying that I could still get sucked in and get thrown off center. And I just, something happened and I just thought, whoa, look at that. You're just as calm as you can be. You know, and I tried to sort of get agitated. I just couldn't because it just was gone, you know. I mean, I sort of tested it. I pushed it a little bit. See if we can get a little hot about this. I couldn't. I mean, you all have had the same experience because that's exactly what's happening. But that's the result of constant effort. And you fail. You fall into the whirlpool. You pick yourself out and you go forward. Oh, during the break, I was talking to someone about the way you respond to your own failings is extremely important on the spiritual path. This comes back to attitude, and this is the very much the even-minded and cheerful, the positive thinking at all times. It is guaranteed that those vrittis are going to suck you down the rabbit hole and take you places you don't want to go. It's just guaranteed because you're not an avatar, chances are. If you are, let me know, but if you were, you know, we would probably be working on it. So if you're not an avatar, and that means not a great, like, great stretch to admit that. That means you were compelled to be born because you have vrittis of karma, which is to say you're not perfect, you have unlearned lessons. It is a fact. You would not be on this planet if you didn't. So, like, when they show up, what is the big excitement? You know, they're not attractive, like, that's the given. They're embarrassing. That's the given. They're humiliating. And they're annoying because, oh, it just means all this effort and all this work and all this tiresomeness. I feel about all those things like I felt just before I came onto the spiritual path when I considered having a nervous breakdown because life was so meaningless. I didn't know what to do. I remember standing in this window in this apartment in San Francisco looking out at the back garden thinking about having a nervous breakdown because it kind of seemed like the circumstances of my life. That would seem like a very, very reasonable response to me, that I could kill myself, which didn't seem like a good idea. I could become a drug addict, which I considered more than becoming an alcoholic, or I could just have a nervous breakdown because, you know, life was just this gigantic, meaningless pit, and how was I going to live? It just was going nowhere. And I just remember thinking, and I think, I sort of like, when I think about it now, I must have projected myself back into the sanitariums I used to have to go to when I had my nervous breakdowns in many previous incarnations. And I just remembered how, you know, it's really tiring to have a nervous breakdown. It's very, very inconvenient. It upsets everyone. Generally costs a lot of money. You know, it just is a big mess. And eventually, they let you out of the sanitarium, and you're right back where you started. I mean, like, what is the point? It's just a big cul-de-sac, and then I'm standing at the same point of meaningless life that I was before I had my nervous breakdown. So I decided it wasn't really smart. Being a drug addict was self-evidently a mess, and suicide didn't seem like a good idea. And so God brought me Swami Kriyananda. He took mercy on me. But the point of all of that is, I stood there, I felt the vritti. That was it, I felt the vritti. Because I have a very, as you all know, because you know me, I have a very, I don't know what the nice word is, I'll use the word overactive. I have an overactive mind. You know, it's really an overactive mind, and it's very imaginative. And I think it's gone crazy probably quite a few times. It's just like I can just sort of look out at the world of madness, and I can just step over there. It's really not very hard for me to go there. I think I quite enjoyed being a loony quite a few times. It just seems a very comfortable world to me. So when I was tempted, I stood there and I thought about having a nervous breakdown because the vritti was there to take me into it. I mean, I have another friend who, every time anything goes wrong, she says she wants to throw herself off a balcony. That's her reaction to things, is to just throw herself off a balcony. She seriously says, if I don't kill myself in this lifetime, I'll consider it a success, because she has a really strong vritti of just dealing with difficulties by throwing herself from a high building. I don't mean to make light of these things, because they're not jokes, but they are just vrittis. They're vrittis. Or you get angry. What I was starting to say is, and this is the whole point of it, we all have these vrittis. And maybe we don't throw ourselves off buildings or have nervous breakdowns, or maybe we do. You know, some of my very good friends have nervous breakdowns. I mean, these things happen to lots of people, you know. But something will happen, and it will take us off center, invariably and often repeatedly. So that's a problem when you go off center. You have to get back on center. But don't double the problem by being so terribly upset about it. It's like the way we regard our failings is more important than the failings. Positive thinking at all times, even-minded and cheerful, courage in the face of obstacles, willpower, devotion, all these things we're talking about. Because inevitably, you will fail. So don't make it two problems, which is, I not only fail, but I have a complex about failing. Having a complex about failing is much worse than just failing. Because failing, you'll eventually get over. But having a complex about it, oh man, you have the difficulty and then you have the layer on top of it. And that one really preoccupies you. So a lot of times, and I've had to say this to many people, look, your only real shortcoming is the way you feel about your shortcomings. You know, your failures are really minor. But your complex about them is a very serious problem. And a lot of it is just an inability to let go of self. You know, just like, the way Swami put it to a woman who was that way was, you're so shocked that you made a mistake that you just have to worship it. Oh, I made an error. An error was made, and it was made by me. An error, an error, an error. How could it be? How could I have done this? You know, like this. And you just make a whole worship ceremony out of me and my failings. And like anybody else looking at you, just sort of like, get over it, you know? I'm tired of it already. And like, you know, remember Lucy in the Peanuts cartoons? I mean, I date myself because it's not so much anymore, but she used to be the psychiatrist. She had a little booth for the psychiatrist, and Charlie Brown would pour out his heart. Her famous line was, you're no different than anyone else. 5 cents, please. That was her fee. It was very good advice. You know, you're no different than anyone else. Yeah, so you made a mistake. Just let it be. But it takes tremendous willpower. Because, see, one of the really strong vrittis in the subconscious mind is, oh, you're just really terrible and you're never going to get free. You know, everybody else is loved by God, but probably not you. You know, everyone is God's child and made of divinity, but you were made from something else. I'm certain of it, you know. And all those promises about how much God loves you, there's always exceptions. You know, it just, that's how it works. And you have to defend it with this. Swami Kriyananda tells us that one of Master's very close and very advanced woman disciples, against his advice, she was a monastic, and against his advice, she married. She had a child. It was a disaster from start to finish. She spent a few years outside of Mount Washington, and then she just came back. And this was before it was all so formalized. She just came back with her child. The husband was long gone, but she just brought the child back, and she just showed up again. Master said, oh, hello, and, you know, just brought her back in. One of the other nuns said, how dare you come back after the way you disobeyed him? She responded, the woman who'd come back had a lot of self-will. She said, what do you want me to do, just worship my mistake for the rest of my life? You know, she just wasn't going to put up with that. Of course she had the right attitude. Here I am, and here's the evidence. You know, here's the baby I wasn't supposed to have. Big karmic mess. But I got myself back, and here I am again. You know, that's how we have to be about it. But it takes more willpower in many ways to do that than almost anything else, because we're so embarrassed. This is where Master says, it's very pleased when you bring him your successes, but he's more sweet when you bring him your failures, because we really want to hold on to our limitations. But that's really when Satan has a hold of us. We have to remember that. That was a long way from what you first asked, but it's important. Okay, any other questions or comments there?
No.
There was one other aspect to my husband's non-death in India, which I'm going to sort of take the opportunity to say this, not that it's exactly on point, but, you know, death and grieving, well, let me back up a little. I was talking to someone earlier today, and this woman is newer on the path, and she was talking about this and this and this and this, and I finally said, look, just pause for a minute. Pretty much everything that you've learned in society is wrong. I mean, it's just wrong. It's not happiness producing. Just everything, you know, about relationships, about body image, about ambition, about money, about security. It's wrong. What's day to the worldly man is night to the yogi. That's what the Gita says. It's just a reverse. It's just what especially this particular culture at this particular time is like outstandingly ignorant. Just like, who are the great people in our society? The sports heroes and the movie stars, who are, for the most part, I mean, I'm sure there's some nice folks among them, but we were at a restaurant in Los Angeles, and they put us in this sort of small private room. It was an Italian restaurant, a very good Italian restaurant, and there was a big widescreen television, and the sound wasn't on, but the picture was on, and it was showing soccer. I realized later it was showing Italy winning the World Cup. And we just sat down at the tables without thinking, and Swami sat facing the screen instead of with his back to the screen. And, you know, for a moment, you kind of like always want to organize everything and make everything just right, and I was going to try to shift it around. But I noticed that he was watching it, and he does something that he often does. He sort of folded his hands, and he got a very blissful smile on his face. And for much of the meal, he just watched the soccer players. And he turned to us at one point, and he said, they're very, very good. You know, they're very good. And he said, and then they must have done some talking. But anyway, he said, their consciousness is in their feet. He said, all of their consciousness is in their feet. You really can't get much lower than that, can you? Yeah, and I sort of looked at him and I realized it was true. Because, you know, soccer takes place at your feet. You don't even use your hands. You do use your head every once in a while. But it was true. All of their energy had to be in their feet. That's how you play. But I mean, it was not judgmental. It was just like, well, wow, look at them. They're just like they live in their feet. Master had a, now let's see, why would I have said that? What could we have been talking about? Well, for whatever it was, I had a very specific reason for bringing that up. Death, thank you. Now, why would I have even brought up that? I just see if I can... Oh, yeah, sports heroes. Now I've got the picture. Right, I've got the picture all... I heard a tennis match somewhere, too, and, you know, you watch tennis. There aren't a lot of sports. You know, ping pong is one, tennis is another, where it's just one-to-one, you know, eyeball to eyeball, just boom, like that. So it's a whole different kind of sport than golf or baseball, where you're at least working in teams. Baseball has the pitcher and the hitter, but still it's just like this. And the voices of those tennis players, their voices were, the only thing I can say is they were so physical. Just the whole consciousness that came out of those bodies was about their bodies. Almost all of them. They said very, very, very physical, willpower oriented, but very physical voices. It just didn't have astral overtones. It was extremely interesting to me because they, to be that good, they had to be really in their bodies. But the point of all of this is that there's just a tremendous number of commonly held myths that we as yogis have to really use our willpower and what we'll come to next week, our discrimination. And one of them is the way we regard death. Now, there is no question that if you've been living with someone and your life is built around them and there's an expectation of relationship and that is interrupted, at the very least that's inconvenient. And it distorts, you know, your vibration, especially if it's someone close, or like a husband or a wife or a child. You know, there's just a certain interweaving. You cut a big piece out of the fabric and you have to fix the hole and weave around it. I know when Jacqueline's husband died, when Vasudeva died, people would say to her, he was very ill, but he died quite suddenly as far as she was concerned. He just died. She never thought he was going to die. He just died like that. They called us at 5 in the morning on Master's birthday about 6 or 7 years ago. Vasudeva's passed away. But people would say to Jacqueline, "Oh, Jacqueline, I'm so sorry you lost your husband." She said, "I didn't lose him. You make it sound like I took him to Walgreens and left him there like my credit card." She said, "I didn't lose him." She said, "I know exactly where he is." You know, she says, "He's just not here now." And, you know, she was very stricken because she liked having him around. They, you know, they had a very nice life together, and she had not planned to have as much of her life as she has had without him. But at the same time, we know about death. We know what death is. We know reincarnation. We know the astral world. And to feel this excessive sense of the necessity to grieve because it's expected of us, because if we really loved him, we would really grieve, it's just not true. And we have to be very discriminating about what's true and what isn't. Because I was asked, well, you know, how would you have felt if David had died? Well, every woman that I know who's lost her husband, I don't think you just sail through it. Lost her husband, see there I said it too, whose husband has gone from this world. I don't think you just sail through it because the fabric of your life has been cut into a new pattern. You have to learn to wear that new costume. But that's different than actually not knowing what's happened. And ideally, we should not grieve. It was interesting. I started watching the beginning of the memorial service for Diamata, and Swami Vishwananda was speaking. And he said, someone asked me if my heart is pained over Daya's passing. I mean, she was 97, and she's been ill for a long time. But of course, she was his spiritual mother. So it doesn't matter how old she was, you know, it's an irreplaceable loss. And he gave a really interesting answer. He said, the extent to which I feel pain is only because my heart isn't big enough to receive all the love that she's showering upon me. Isn't that a beautiful answer? Yeah, my heart is habituated to being too small, and in other words, I can't really go to the place where she would comfort me. So he didn't say one way or another what he was feeling, but that's how he answered the question. You know, I can't accept the will of God sufficiently. I'm still caught in my own. And after Master died, Durgamata talks about in her book that some of the nuns were weeping by the crypt. And Master came to one of the more detached nuns and said, you know, oh, came to her. And Master said, why are you crying? He said, why are you crying to one who was crying? I'm not in there. And then he said to Durga, why are you mourning? And Durga said, because we're selfish. And he said something like, leave it to Durga to tell the truth. I mean, this is all a post-death conversation, an inner conversation, because we're selfish, because we're thinking about ourselves. I don't just mean we don't want you to die, but we're just thinking about ourselves. We're self-centered. And so we've taken this event, which is as natural as birth, and we've made it all about us. But what do I not have anymore that I have wanted? It doesn't mean that it's not serious when people die. It's a serious thing when people transition. You know, look at all the energy there is at birth. You know, it's a very serious thing when people transition. But it doesn't have to be a trauma. Even-minded and cheerful, positive thinking at all times. What did we think? That people would live forever? You know, it's like, what is with this? Did we think we would live forever? That's why Maria Warner's passing was so inspiring. Okay, I have had cancer before, and now it's in my brain, and I'm going to die within the month. Okay, goodbye. It's just about how she did it. Okay, goodbye. Just cut it all off, just like that. And someone said it was interesting because she did it just completely solitary. As soon as she knew that it was over, she just cut off all her relationships. I said to David, it's so funny. I don't know what I would do if I came to die. But my actual impulse, I imagined, if I was like Maria, knew that was happening. Maria just went into her house, said, I don't want to see anyone. And she pretty much stayed to that and just left. I said, I would probably put my bed by the front window and I'd open the front and back doors. And I would just say, you know, all the people I've known in my life, here I am, this is the end, come on over, we're having a party. That would just be my first impulse. And both things are fine. That's what Paula did when she died. She didn't invite everyone over, but she invited a lot of people over, and she had us stay with her until she breathed her last. Just a completely opposite way of doing it. And in her last half hour, she said, this is very hard, you have to help me. Her last words were God, Christ, Guru. But her close to last words are, ooh, this is very hard, you have to help me. And when she was ready to die, she had gone to sleep for a while, and then she woke us all up. There were like 30 of us in the hospital room with her, in the halls, in the empty rooms. The hospital just let us take over for 3 days. And she woke us up. Everybody up, everybody come on in here. She just passed the word, and we all got up from wherever we were sleeping. I mean, you know, people are stretched out on the gurneys in the hall. It was the craziest thing. She woke everybody up and got us all in there. And, you know, half an hour later, she breathed her last. She had us just sit with her and help her through it. And Maria didn't want to see anyone. There's just different ways to do it. But the result was the same. Close to Paula's last words were her husband, too, who sat down next to her when she woke everyone up. Sat down next to her, put his arm around her. She turned to him as if she'd never known him in her life. She said, don't touch me, I can still feel it. This is what she said. You know, it's like, you've been my husband, it's been great, but it's over now. And you know, she was very loving, and he knew that he loved her, but he realized, oh, I'm still being personal with her, and now she's finished. So in the last, she went to that same place, but she wanted our help to go there. Amazing. That's willpower. That's courage. Okay, pardon me? Each one does it in his own way. And Daya said to me, she was so, Daya Taylor, said she really appreciated Maria's example because the only previous example we'd had of such a conscious and dynamic death was Paula. And Paula invited everyone in. But I realized later also, Paula actually, she went to the hospital. She had 3 days. They told her that they tried to treat her, and they could see they couldn't treat her. So they basically told her, you're finished, there's nothing we can do. And she just sat in her hospital bed. At one point I said to her, Paula, they're concerned because you haven't peed in quite a long time. And she just sort of looked at me like this. I said, is it very painful to pee? She went like that. And she said, I'm hoping to die before I have to pee again. It was just like she was so, you know, out there. But she had some business to finish with lots of different people. And for 3 days she sat in the hospital bed and people came just intuitively, and a few people she called. She asked them to come, or if they couldn't come, she phoned them. And she just finished her business, you know, and everybody, and then she was actually thinking, like, is there anything else? Is there anything else? Is there anybody else? And I've repeated this to you, but some of you haven't heard it. Paula was such a pure soul. She was so fantastic. There was this man named PJ who had been murdered, actually. He had come out of the the ghetto and out of the drug trade, and he kind of went back into it. We don't actually know if he actually went into the drug trade or he just went back to visit his people, but somebody opened the door and shot him, so he was murdered. And she'd been very close with him, but sometimes they'd had some friction. It wasn't a romance, it was just a friendship. So on her very last, after she'd called this other woman and made peace with her, I said, okay, is there anything else? She said, well, once I was so mad at PJ that when he gave me a rose bush, I didn't plant it for a whole month. And we all looked at each other like, oh, Lord, please, when I die, let that be the only stain on my consciousness. You know, that I took it out on the rose bush. Please, please. And she said, but I can work that out from him with him on the other side. Because there was nothing she could do about it now. But she actually sat there and finished like that. Maria obviously didn't feel she had that to deal with because she just didn't relate to anyone. Paula really did. I mean, she was they were polar opposites as people. So her interaction with people was very deliberate. You know, she was really with all of